This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The New York Times film critic A.O. Scott described the new film The Master as imposing, confounding, and altogether amazing. The film won top awards at the Venice Film Festival and had its North American premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. Our next guest is the film's director and writer, Paul Thomas Anderson. He's also written and directed the films Heart 8, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and There Will Be Blood. The Master is mostly set in 1950, after a World War II veteran, Freddie Quell, played by Joaquin Phoenix, returns to America. Quell is mentally unstable and having a hard time fitting in anywhere. He stumbles onto a party being held by a cult-like group called The Cause and is taken in by them. Their leader is the charismatic Lancaster Dodd, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. His wife, Peggy Dodd, played by Amy Adams, is suspicious of Quell and afraid he'll be a disruptive force. But Lancaster Dodd welcomes the challenge of taming Freddy's animal instincts. Terry began with a scene from The Master. The members of The Cause are at a party, where a skeptic challenges some of Lancaster Dodd's teachings, like his claims about reincarnation and how he can lead followers through their past lives through a technique he calls processing.
I still find it difficult to see the proof with regards to past lives that your movement claims.
Would you care to submit yourself to processing? Look through the telescope, as my friend says.
Well, perhaps another time. You've also said that these methods, cause methods, can cure leukemia, according to your book. And
some forms of leukemia. In being able to access past lives, we are able to treat illnesses that may have started back thousands, even trillions of years.
Trillions?
With a T, sir.
The Earth is not understood to be more than a few billion years old.
Well, even the smartest of our current scientists can be fooled, yes?
You can understand skepticism.
Yes, yes. For without it, we'd be positives and no negatives. Therefore, zero charge. We must have it.
Good science, by definition, allows for more than one opinion, doesn't
it? Which is why our gathering of data is so far-reaching.
Otherwise, you merely have the will of one man, which is the basis of cult. Is it not?
Tis. And thankfully, we are, all of us, working at breakneck speeds and in unison towards capturing the mind's fatal flaws and correcting it back to its inherent state of perfect. Whilst righting civilization and eliminating war and poverty, and therefore the atomic threat.
Well, I find it quite difficult to comprehend, or more to the point, believe that you believe, sir, that time travel hypnosis therapy can bring world peace and cure cancer.
I have never been to the pyramids. Have you?
No.
And yet we know that they are there. Because learned men have told us so. May I ask, what is your name?
John Moore.
Mr. Moore, if I may. Is there something frightening to you about the Cause's travels into the past?
Frightening?
Yes.
No.
What scares you so much about traveling into the past, sir?
I'm not.
Are you afraid that we might discover that our past has been reshapen, perverted? And perhaps what we think we know of this world is false information.
Paul Thomas Anderson, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on The Master. It's such a fine film.
Thanks, Terry.
So you had to create a series of exercises, processing as it's called, in the film, where people are put through things, they're put through their past lives, they're put through certain exercises to help, you know, kind of get in touch with their better selves, their higher selves. And, you know, one of those exercises is just being asked a question and then having to repeat the answer over and over again. So, like, say your name, say it again. Are you thoughtless in your remarks? Mm-hmm. Do you linger at bus stations for pleasure? How did you come up with that as something that, you know, the leader of this group would put new people through as an almost initiation process into the group?
Well, it's inspired by the actual questionnaire that's out there as it relates to Scientology, but I sort of changed it and switched it around. And I came to that many, many years ago and actually found it was a great way to just sort of start writing, you know, forgetting any implications of making a film or a story about this. It was really just like kind of writer's block and sitting around and just sort of the best way for me to start writing a story is to get two characters talking to each other. And if you got questions from one, you're going to have to get answers from the other, and you can kind of start to find out who's coming out of you when you're writing, if you know what I mean. And so I just started doing it as an exercise, and that was probably one of the scenes that I kind of wrote first in the movie, in the middle of kind of the middle, sort of working from the middle. But I wrote that years and years ago, didn't really know who these people were, so I just started discovering who they were by what their answers would be.
So you started writing a scene that had say your name, say it again, without knowing
yeah.
who was in the scene or where it was headed?
Yeah, but I found out when I was writing it, you know.
Now, you wrote the part of the master, the cult leader, with Philip Seymour Hoffman in mind. The first time you used him, that you worked with him, was in Boogie Nights, where he's a member of the film crew that's shooting the porn films, and he has a crush on the porn star, Dirk Diggler. The Hoffman character is gay, but he's very awkward. He's very uncomfortable. I think he's very uncomfortable in his own body. He comes off as a weak person, and now you've made him into such a kind of strong person. It's interesting that you've seen both sides of him as an actor and seen both capabilities in him.
Well, I know he's my friend, but I have to say there's just nothing he can't do. I feel so lucky to have met Phil and hooked up with him. You know, I can remember, you know, growing up, all I wanted to do was make films. You sort of imagine yourself on the set making movies with a camera and lights, and you sort of imagine as a kid you're going to be sort of, I don't know, making westerns outside. Never in my fantasy did I see anybody that looked like Phil Hoffman being a part of that picture, but here we are, and somewhere along the way I found this actor who I just think can do anything, and is capable of so much that you can throw anything at him.
So the Philip Seymour Hoffman character is kind of corpulent and full of life and so social that he has followers, whereas the Joaquin Phoenix character is kind of wizened. He's survived World War II, but he's certainly not mentally intact. We don't know how he went into the war, but he certainly didn't come out of it very well. His spine is twisted and his posture almost bizarre. And he holds his hands on his hips with his shoulders pulled, like coming forward, right. And he's all bent over. It's almost like a physical expression of his inner anguish and dislocation, things that he doesn't have the words to express. How much of that did he come up with himself?
All of it. At a certain point, kind of early on, I think Joaquin let me know that his shoulder is kind of from birth, he's got a kind of a messy shoulder, and he's probably spent a lot of time trying to hide it or stand up straight so that if he kind of twists his body around, and he sort of said, do you think it'd be all right if I do this? And I said, sure, great. But a couple days into the film, he just sort of was feeling more comfortable and just kept sliding into the skin that he was doing, that kind of, this movement that were so incredible. I just didn't want to jinx anything and say, what are you doing or what's going on? You know, it's kind of, you're in the middle of make-believe. You don't want to break the spell. You just kind of want to watch him do whatever he's doing. And I kind of have my own theories about it because, you know, he puts his hands on his hips. There's sort of stuff about his kidneys being all torn up from the war. Maybe something happened. Maybe it's just easier. Maybe it's comfortable for him to kind of reach back and hold his kidneys and help him stand. But then again, yeah, there's always that thing, you know, sort of the way somebody holds himself is an extension of what's going on with them on the inside.
Now, I read he stayed in character through the movie, even on the set.
Yeah,
is that
whatever
right?
That means. It's such a weird phrase, isn't it? Staying in character kind of connotates some kind of bizarre. I don't know. We've got to find a new way to say stays in character. Maybe how about an enormous level of concentration? That's what I would say.
Right.
Everybody knows it's make-believe, and you're just trying to do your absolute best at make-believe. And to do that, sometimes you really have to concentrate and tune a lot of stuff out. And that's very hard, very hard.
But just physically, to have to stay twisted like that when you're not in a scene, that must be very uncomfortable.
Right. But probably fun. I dare say probably a kind of joy to sort of, I mean, somebody said you can check out of your skin for 3 months
mm-hmm.
and be somebody else. don't worry, you'll still be there when you get back in 3 months. Would you do it? I think many of us would if we could.
But that's so interesting because people are checking out of themselves when they're acting in your films. And because your films get so kind of beneath the surface of character that they are really checking out of their themselves and checking into these characters. But you have to be so kind of aware of everything because you're the writer-director. You have to be taking care of everything. Like everybody's... You know, everybody's in this make-believe world in a way, but are you? You're thinking the budget also, probably. I mean, you know, that, like, what time are the union hours over?
Yeah, you know, but I don't want to give the impression that you're sort of working with some crazy people and you've sort of got to be the... Everybody, you know you're making a movie and everybody knows what the hours are and what... a kind of how to kind of create maximum effect, you know. Mm-hmm. No one likes to go to work in the middle of the night. No one likes to kind of do really heavy duty stuff early in the morning. You know, you're sort of working on making this thing and you work together and you're trying to get everybody at their best and make sure that the hours aren't too crazy and make sure that the schedule allows that you're doing a kind of a lighter scene after you did a heavy one or whatever it is. It's all that kind of time management, and everybody appreciates that. Everybody's happy about that, you know. At its best, a film set is when everybody knows what's going on and everybody's working together. At its worst is when something's been lost in the communication and an actor's not sure how many shots are left or what's going on and the makeup department's confused and every, you know, I mean, I'm sure the angle overhead watching that moment is like all these kind of little ants banging into each other and going different directions. And those moments happen, and they're a drag. They're a drag for everybody, but try to get back on course and go right.
In The Master, Amy Adams plays the wife of the cult leader, and she's like his third or fourth wife. But through his group, through his cult called The Cause, he's perfected marriage. Marriage is better now than it used to be. He tells that to everybody. But anyway, she's really like the power behind him in some ways. She has this like odd kind of control. And she was recently on our show. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about a scene, and the story behind the scene really surprised me. There's a scene in which she has to read a page of like Victorian pornography to the Joaquin Phoenix character, to this lost soul who's now on the fringes of this cult. And she's trying to desensitize him to his sexual obsessions. And what she told me was that you came on the set one day, that scene had not been in the script. You came on the set, gave her this page of a book to read and said, okay, read it. and that was her preparation. So tell us the story from your point of view.
It's pretty close to that. We had a sequence in the film where the sequence that you're referring to, where some things were written and some things were just kind of very loosely sketched out. And I knew I wanted to collect a lot of different things. I had a kind of list of different exercises that I'd either made up or pulled from different sources. That day in particular was a day where a bunch of our cameras had broke. We were shooting these 65mm cameras and we were supposed to do a scene. And the cameras broke. So we kind of found ourselves with about 3 or 4 hours while those cameras were getting fixed where we could shoot with this other smaller camera, regular traditional 35mm camera. And Amy was around that day, and it was a kind of a great situation where we were shooting, which is this kind of island called Mare Island, where basically all our locations were in about a 1 or 2 block radius. So we had a lot of freedom to do whatever came up, and we had some time to kill, and Amy was around, and I presented this idea to her. I think we tried it with some other people, too, doing it just to see how it worked. And it wasn't as effective. And I kind of thought that the best idea was to have Amy do it, probably just the perverse thrill of seeing her character read these kind of really dirty, dirty, dirty words. You know, there's something great about that. And, yeah, it was really hard not to laugh. I had to step out of the room. She did great.
Did you really?
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, it was great. Really fun.
No. The film opens in the final days of World War II, just as the war is ending, and then it kind of jumps ahead to 1950. Why did you want to set it then?
You know, why wouldn't you? It's a great, you know, just on the surface level, that time is so great. I mean, just from a kind of pure cars and girls and outfits and hairdos and music point of view, on that real simple level, that's just like, you know, delicious time, you know, for making a film. You know, I just love that era. I've always have. It was kind of my dad's era, I think, in terms of, certainly in terms of music and coming back from the war. And it's just, it's thick and full of stuff. You know, all the songs of that period I grew up listening to with my dad driving around. So, you know, anytime I get a whiff of that stuff, I'm just sort of go to it like it's freshly baked cookies to me.
So you mentioned that you knew a lot of music from this period from your father. Did he fight in World War II?
He was there. He was in the Navy, stationed mainly in Guam. I don't think he did any fighting. I think he was trying. He was fixing airplanes and knew just where the beer was stashed and playing saxophone in bands and stuff like that. You know, every picture I have of him, he's got a beer in his hand. every single picture from the war he's got. So he was pretty good about probably finding ways to get out of fighting. But again, we never really talked that much about it.
So there weren't images that you used in the movie that were based on experiences that he shared with you?
No, not that he shared with me. Some of the photographs of him on a beach, he sort of stuck in my mind's eye. You know, one of the stories in the film, it comes from Jason Robards, who famously fought in the war, was in the Navy.
And he starred in your movie Magnolia.
That's right. I worked with him in Magnolia, and he told me the story of coming back. I don't remember what boat he was on, but he was coming back, and VJ Day was announced, and they'd run out of booze, and they broke into the torpedoes and drank the booze out of there. And the way he tells it is he woke up the next morning on the mast of the ship, you know, and an inch either way, he would have fallen to his death. And that story just stuck with me as a great story and something to get into a film.
It's a very disorienting image when you see Joaquin Phoenix on the top of the mast. It's just a really odd angle. So he drank booze from the torpedoes? I don't...
Well, it's ethanol, I think, that helps propel the torpedoes and make it move, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some raunchy paint thinner kind of rot gut in your film.
I think the idea with ethanol is that if you put just a few drops and then squeeze as many coconuts or papaya, whatever you've taken back with you from the islands, you sort of 99% juice and maybe 1% ethanol, you'll get a pretty good buzz.
Well, Paul Thomas Anderson, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air. I really appreciate it.
It's always great to talk to you, Terry. Thank you.
Paul Thomas Anderson speaking with Terry Gross. He wrote and directed the new film, The Master. You can hear the full interview and watch clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Charlie Kyer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.